This is Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with co-host Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist of this Health and Happiness show on 95.9 FM and KGVM.org here in the Gallatin Valley. Thank you for listening. We thank KGVM and the Montana Psychological Association Public Education Committee for promoting this presentation and all the others. Dr. Suzanne now introduces today's program.
It seems we all seem to feel like life should be easy and accommodating. A different perspective is given by Dr. Scott Peck, noted psychiatrist. He says, life is difficult. Perhaps if we begin our journey with this perspective, we can navigate the inevitable roadblocks along life's pathway. We can do it more effectively. A Montana survey from a little while back found that 1 in 5 across our state are reporting that they need help with their emotional and mental health. Obviously, we all struggle at times. And we have with us today a young person with a unique and helpful outlook after experiencing difficult and even life-threatening experiences and thought patterns. Please help me welcome Josie Alpin McCullough. What is your message for us today, Josie?
I would say, to begin, thank you for having me, and I am very happy to share kind of from going from pain to purpose multiple times, learning to live, heal, and help. I would like to say we'll touch on suicide, trauma, recovery, and also resilience, humor, and hope, just to show people that there's a tie between all of them, and it's tough. And it seems to be kind of a interesting circle, but it's okay. And I know I'm not alone, and I know a lot of people are struggling with similar issues. And I just want them to know as well that they're not alone.
I think that's what we all need to believe, is that we're not alone. Although when you're feeling that, it's difficult somehow to jump from here to there. What would you tell people about jumping from feeling alone to realizing people care?
I would say it is extremely tough, and I've been trying to learn more on a do mindset and almost trick my body into getting going so that my mind can kind of connect as we go. Because people do, it's really, really difficult to ask for help. And that's one thing that I think I kind of learned through childhood, that I had a hard time asking for help, and I felt very abandoned in a lot of, throughout my childhood. And it's difficult when you have that tunnel vision of what you think you know versus what's actually out there.
Absolutely. And so for the many listeners who are struggling, and we know from statistics that Montana has a really high, usually the very highest or in the top three, suicide rate. And first of all, I want to say about suicide that we're going to be talking about difficult things today. And if you're feeling down or out or in any capacity, like you can't go on, you need to think about calling 988, and you need to think about calling 911, or just going to see your doctor or calling a good friend, because it's not easy. And it's of interest that in recent disclosures, when interviewed people who attempted to die by suicide, but then somehow survived, maybe jumped off that New York City Manhattan Bridge and managed to be picked back up. They've said, I didn't really want to die. I just wanted the pain to stop. And so that's where we could really help one another, I think, is getting the pain to stop. And so Josie has done a magnificent job of working on this. And as she tells us always, it's a work in progress. And we really appreciate that. So how would you think about those thoughts, Josie?
I think what you said is all very, very true. Because I touching on later, I was going to say the same thing, you know, it's, I didn't want to die. I wanted to live. I wanted the pain to stop. And that was really the hardest part. And carrying a lot of pain with me and realizing how much I was carrying with me, even after a lot of major successes in my life, that pain was still there and I did not work on it. And I did push it down. And even, yeah, after some of the best life events and achievements that I ever made, I still fell just as hard. But it is possible to pick yourself up and climb even further.
Were any of these resources that Suzanne mentioned helpful to you?
Yes, very. And like the 988 helpline, that is something I used a lot. It actually saved me multiple times. And kind of later on, if we have time, I'll touch on some of the reasons why I didn't call my family. But some of the people I did call, like, for example, my professor, the 988 helpline, I was ready to put a bullet in my mouth. And they suggested leaving my gun outside and asking for someone to pick it up. I was afraid to reach out to family for reasons I'll touch on later, but I ended up reaching out to a professor of mine, and they came and took the gun. I didn't have to see them. It was as simple as that, but it really was, and that just being removed saved my life and saved me from myself.
Proximity is important then, having availability. We had, just to touch on this thought you gave us, we had the head of the veterinarians for the state of Montana on a while back, because there was an extremely high suicide rate among veterinarians, of all things. And she said she felt that part of it was right next to them all day, every day, is a cabinet full of medications that they use to put animals to sleep, and that it looks so simple and so easy, and if they're in pain, it's so easy to reach into that cabinet, which opened my eyes so much that proximity does make a difference. So what you're saying to people out there is call for help. I like that. Even, it doesn't matter who, just call someone, figure out who to reach out to, but then have them take the proximity away.
Yeah, definitely. Safety measures in place were huge for me throughout my recovery and transition back into normal life, and my transition back into finding kind of purpose and meaning and just living. Like, I have like books right next to my bed to help myself read more. And proximity can, with the negative things, creating more of a distance between those, and then proximity with the positive things, keeping those closer so that you have those subtle reminders to take care.
I have a statement to make about Josie. It's come to my attention that this young person has bought a home, gotten jobs, does volunteer work. She in spite of this wonderfulness, also still had that pain lurking and has since done a lot.
And a great writer.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes, we've seen samples of her writing in preparation for this talk, and she's got beautiful literary function as well. So,
what about the Help Center you mentioned in there?
The Help Center has been absolutely amazing as a resource, and I've actually grown close to two of the people that work for SACS, which is a funding source for the Help Center. So if you like thrift shopping, I love thrift shopping.
Okay, everyone, just big ad here, right downtown SACS thrift store, right downtown Bozeman, and every bit of the profit goes in to providing funds for the Help Center, which goes into providing suicide prevention line, mm-hmm. counseling, yeah. So many ways. So tell us how they helped you, how you got attached to them, and what exactly happened there.
Well, I knew one of the staff members from commissioning my bowls there, some artwork that I do, and I grew closer to them after my kind of fall, and was invited to look at some projects with them, meet up with them, and actually it's really nice because we will meet at 6 at a coffee shop every Sunday, and it even on days I didn't want to go, I would go because that like community I've realized is so important, and all the times that I've really fallen, that's been one of the hardest things. It's like, it feels like I need to relearn to talk, to describe the pain. I fall hard, and then it's like, well, where does it hurt? What hurts? What helps? Who can help you? And being able to describe that pain and almost relearning how to communicate was, and still is, like a big, big small project that I'm working on for myself.
Very descriptive. Yeah. And so you, having been kind of at your lowest ebb, have had all kinds of treatments. Mm-hmm. And what your statement in your written effort to us is that, hey, all of you out there, these work. There are these things that are very helpful, and I'd like for you to think about those if you're depressed, and to use those, and reach out to the medical professionals that provide those, because there's treatment for depression and stress and feeling lost, and it's not just a pat on the back. So like you mentioned that you read a book that was very helpful. You mentioned the food bank was helpful, and you mentioned that everybody should go to counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciated that. The book was The Body Keeps the Score.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that book.
So that book has been absolutely life-changing for me, especially at this time. Being able to learn about my trauma and hear like the scientific side of trauma and what you can do to help yourself and others. And it was helpful in being trauma informed, not only for me, but for other folks that I deal with. Like when I'm volunteering, I volunteer at HRDC Homeward Point, and because I have also experienced homelessness and some of the other added on things that come with that, and other outside factors. And so being trauma-informed, not only for me, was a huge step for myself to grow and understand where my pain came from, but it was also a huge step in considering others, which I feel like is the highest form of love. And I think I mentioned in... I've mentioned this a few times, but volunteering I always say it as like a condition of my life parole, because, you know, it makes me feel good and helping others helps me, and I will probably do it for life.
Well, let's hope so, because being able to reach out and help lift another person up, what lifts you up right along with them, and you've learned that so well.
Yeah, it definitely gives you a sense of purpose.
We'd like at this point to officially invite people listening to come and volunteer at the Help Center.
HRDC.
And HRDC, yeah. Because they will train you in how to help with the suicide prevention. They'll train you with that phone line. They'll train you in being at the center and helping. They'll train you in all different kinds of ways to be helpful to your community. Remember, if one in five of us is saying, I really need help, we need to be aware and we need to be alert and we need to be busy with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what Josie is telling us, that she's reached peaks several times where I think it's okay now. I'm fine. And now I've bought a house. And now, wow, I'm just up here. But what she's warning us is that you always have to be aware and be able to reach out when depression or stress hits you so hard.
Yeah, and that is so true. And one thing that I've learned multiple times in life is that, you know, we're all kind of just a hop, skip, and a throw away from possibly experiencing homelessness, possibly experiencing depression or major depressive episode, entering into crisis and or feelings of purposelessness. And after that happens, I mean, a way that I've found my purpose again was through volunteering. I don't know if it's my main purpose, but it makes me feel like I have a purpose. And I love that. But yeah.
Well, the community loves it as well. I mean, yeah. That helps everyone when we give our times and our hearts and reach out our hand to others. I know Arliss is a psychologist, has all of his lifetime been working in this area, and started several helping agencies that provide a lot. What do you see that, for instance, the parents out there could do when their kids seem a little bit lost, or they worry that their kids are depressed, or should they maybe take more notice that they're not noticing even? So,
yeah, I also I read an amazing book recently called The Anxious Generation, and that had a big it was a little intense, but I think the truth is always intense. And it talked a lot about kind of the great rewiring and how the digital age has changed our ways of communicating. And it has for the better, but it also has, in terms, divided us. Less community, more artificial community. I think, I'm not a parent myself, but I think bringing back like a play-based childhood and protecting your children online and not being as helicopter parent-y not in person, but in real life, I think that is important, because that's the way we learn. And even sitting down for an hour for dinner with no phones, I think those connections need to be built and kept, because I've noticed with myself, my communication is not the best. It's tougher in person, but it's something that I know that I can learn, and it's something that I know that I've held before, and I've been a people person all my life, but after some significant events, life events, it has put up some walls and made it easier to seek out kind of artificial, by my time, connections that don't actually feed the connection that you need from a community, and you don't learn from those as much. But yeah.
I was going to also ask you, thank you for that, but you mentioned in your writing a Native American tuition waiver that helped you work with some education. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that, if you could.
Oh, that old chestnut. I love that. I love that one, but it's also a tough one. So after I battled with a bit of sobriety and just pain, childhood pain, I was able to overcome that, buy my house. I enrolled in school for cybersecurity, and I noticed that there's this Native American tuition waiver, which I ended up having problems because I am not sure if any of our listeners are familiar with blood quantum, but it's used to measure like what percentage of what you are, and it's only used in with Native Americans, I think, horses and dogs. So it's a little degrading in ways. But I worked with a lawmaker to try and have that law rewritten to take blood quantum out. Unfortunately, that did not pass. But that was another little peak, and you know, peak and valley. But it's those little ones. They're tough, but sometimes it doesn't work out, and you can either keep trying or learn the lesson here, or move on to the next big thing, the next goal. Try not to let those slow me down. It kind of bummed me out, but maybe I'll come back to it. Who knows?
Absolutely. I know it was disappointing it didn't pass the first time, but mm-hmm. Hey, we need to remember that Colonel Sanders was 75 when he started Kentucky Fried Chicken, mm-hmm. and he'd failed at everything all of his life, mostly before that. So, hey, hang in there.
Hang in there.
Remember Colonel Sanders.
There's a chance for you and me then.
No. Oh, yeah. And once you said, I would set the bar so high for myself that when I did not reach it.
That's one that I do a lot. And, you know, I think we all expect great things and growing and living to be linear, but the reality is it's not. It's gradual. It's tough. I really try to stick to like a do it now mantra so that I do like even get just getting up. I'll put water bottles around my bed because of the proximity, and drink water before I go to bed so that I have to get up. It's a little personal, but so I have to get up to use the bathroom. I'll like chug water. And that's one way to make myself do that now and get up at 6 or whatever time I'm trying to get up. But
good strategy, my dear.
Strategic work that I put in place against myself to keep myself myself. And it's those little things, but
sure is, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Do you mind repeating the question?
Well, we were talking about actually how you manage when you feel like you've set your goals too high and you don't feel like you're living up to them.
Yeah.
By the way, that's not just you, honey.
I know. Thank you. I appreciate you. Setting high goals. I recall in my job interview, actually, for the health department, I remember saying one of my strengths is I perform really well under pressure. I sometimes tend to bite off more than I can chew, but I'm usually able to pull it off. And I didn't realize like how much of how long I guess I've been in survival mode, almost fight or flight, working well under pressure. It is a great strength, but when you always keep yourself under pressure, that can break down your body and mind.
Sorry, it's a huge stressor.
It is, yes.
Really huge.
Very huge, yeah. Stressor. But
yeah, in fact, when you stress yourself out like that, according to the Mayo Clinic, hang on just one second, they talk about what it does is releases chemicals that impact your overall performance and cognition and health.
Cortisone, for example.
Yeah, cortisol, many others. So when you're trying to keep yourself at that very high level, it takes extra energy, extra, extra, extra everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're always at this high level of having to focus on that, having to achieve, having to work.
Mm-hmm.
So then what probably can't happen as well is any possible relaxation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And that, rest, yeah.
That and like even, I think, I know from when you're in fight or flight mode, like your frontal cortex, which is in the front of your brain, it is, you're not thinking straight. You're focused on, all your senses are in hyper arousal mode and you are not able to take in, process information correctly. And it affects your memory as well. And it's really, it's tough because I think it's the brain is an amazing muscle, but in order for it to work right, you have to be able to unplug, relax, be calm, find ways to bring your body out of that hyper arousal mode. And I one thing I really like to do is I like to touch on like my senses or go on a doll walk and, you know, count five things that are blue or smell the air and listen to three things that I can name or touch things. Yeah. Bring myself back to the present so that my body knows we're safe. There's nothing going to hurt us. We don't need to be in this hyper arousal. And it's quite amazing how these little things will bring you back and can bring you back. And practicing them when you don't need them is it's very important because when you do need them, your body will just do it. Your mind will realize and work you through that.
You allude to the influence of family. As psychologists coming from a very dysfunctional home as well, that's a very complicated issue because I've gone through many stages all the way up to my old age about hating them and some things that happened, feeling like that they were on purpose wanting to mold you in a way that was dysfunctional. And then I've evolved at times into working on the forgiveness mode of saying, well, maybe they were doing the best they could under the circumstances, knowing in both my parents' situation, very dysfunctional backgrounds, poor education, lack of finances. But that varies, and I can't say that I've ever quite figured it out, but you have to accept certain things. But in my older age now, I see that they really probably did the only thing, not maybe quite, but the only thing they could do under the circumstances of their background, what they believed, lack of education, but that's still complicated. Mm-hmm. How does this affect you?
It's so many layers. I feel like I've battled with that with a lot of family who have had a hand in my pain, and it's really hard to forgive them. There's this amazing Buddha quote that I love, you know, drinking or holding on to anger is like drinking a poison and expecting the other person to die. And really, you know, what happens is it eats you up. It keeps you, it keeps you resentful and angry. And I think a lot of, I think a lot of what happened and what I went through in childhood was just my family doing what they needed to do to survive. And not that any of what they did is excusable, but knowing that they were probably in survival mode and just trying to get through it, knowing that, it makes it easier to give them grace and give myself grace, because I care about them. I know they care about me, and I know what the intent was. And I believe a lot of people, I don't think a lot of people intentionally try to hurt others, and I wouldn't believe that my family was ever trying to intentionally hurt me.
And the stigma of seeking help, it was much greater then, although it's still here now, but not to the same degree, is that there's no way they would be able to seek out help. I think in my family, it's so interesting, my mother would take us to the local, the small farm area of southwestern Oklahoma, to the doctor, a physician in a small town, Snyder, Oklahoma. And he really had the insight, and I recall him as maybe being my first person who kind of recognizes children who are especially anxious or depressed. And that was okay. You could take him to the medical doc, who in his own way could help you with any emotional behavioral things. So we've come a long way since then, but as you still know, there's a stigma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I see the stigma in like people I know, and it's hard when you tell someone, you know, I believe everyone should go to counseling. Even just breaking that down to, I believe everyone should talk to one person a week for an hour to release things. And if that person is a paid person that knows you, that's okay. If it's a person that isn't paid that knows you, that's also okay. But there are resources out there for qualified people that can help you walk through things. I think venting is important, but I think it's also important if the person is qualified and can give you next steps or give you tools to work through a lot. I had a really hard time finding my voice, and still kind of do in certain places. But one thing that helped me kind of find my voice was journaling. And journaling at a time when I'm angry or something happens, my brain feels like a pinball machine a lot of the times, with like the bottom slots closed, so everything's just dinging. There's bright lights and noises, and you know, that it just builds up like a pressure cooker up in there. So it's nice to be able to write it out, get it out. If you need help, like right away. And I'm talking in terms of more, you know, a situation is frustrating, like someone cut you off in the car and you're still thinking about it later, you know, maybe write it down how it made you feel, and you know, it kind of opens up the other perspectives.
You mean don't honk and chase them down?
Yes, honk and chase them down. Don't do that.
Especially in where some people carry firearms.
Exactly, yes, exactly. But yeah, it's helped. I know writing things and kind of thinking about maybe what the other person's going through too, that paradoxical thinking has been helpful for me a lot. And usually when I get into that state of being able to think about the other person is after I get my feelings out. I name the feelings, put them on paper, and then I'm able to kind of process and think, okay, well, maybe they're in a rush on the way to the hospital, you know, or maybe it's an emergency. But understanding that, you know, there's always more to the picture.
I like the fact you mentioned tools, and that would be one thing that I think everybody needs to develop, a toolbox in their minds. Like over the years, like you mentioned in one of your writings, cognitive behavior therapy, the distortions that many of us grew up with, that we grew up with the same assumptions oftentimes that our family had. It's all or nothing thinking, or catastrophic thinking, our mental filter, or goes on and on, is that if something happens, seems very bad, hey, is it a catastrophe? Most of the time, almost all the time, it's not. Mm-hmm. So how do you talk back to yourself? And people say, well, that person's talking to himself. Well, in a positive way. You're talking to yourself to help you get beyond an old habit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I love CBT, DBT. I didn't love it as much when I was younger. And I think it's also, there was kind of a bias against it because I felt like, you know, I was abandoned and had to be in this place doing these things. But and I didn't realize they were tools, but these tools are absolutely amazing. And I actually, my most recent kind of crash, I went to a place and did electric convulsive therapy. But before going into that, I had kind of Googled myself into a worry storm. And I heard that it makes you, like, it lowers your IQ, all this and that. And I don't think all of that is true, but and I heard that, like, it can affect your memory for a short period, but my mind was like, oh, I'm not going to be able to remember anything forever. So I had these things already in my mind that, oh, my memory's going to get erased. I'm going to get dumb. And
the distortions
mind,
about...
Yes, yeah, extreme distortions.
I'm glad you mentioned that because ECT was used many years ago for a number of disorders, some of them appropriate, some inappropriate, but it's gotten to the point that it could even be done on an outpatient basis, and it's not used routinely, but it's used with severe depression very effectively, and psychotropics, there are a number of them that help, and also one that is that keeps coming up is when people learn to exercise, to really physically stay in shape. It's another tool that many of us don't use in order to combat these feelings.
In fact, just last week, a new study came out telling us that exercise could be equal to or even a little bit more effective for stress and depression than medications, which was a new finding, but it makes sense. And I think really what you said about taking a walk when you feel down. Mm-hmm. But how about taking a brisk walk, taking a run, going in swimming laps? Everybody, let's start thinking about exercise as one of the best things that could possibly happen. And we can testify that it's helpful. Over the years, those who exercise, they just seem to have an upper hand. Mm-hmm. And back to your thoughts about dealing with depression, there's an old book title that I've always loved called I'm Okay, You're Okay, where we tend to forgive ourselves and others, and like if we feel like we failed on some particular project or work or life, just learn how to let go of it. Don't hang on to things that happened 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Somehow, if you can let go of those things, like you said, forgiveness helps erase that stress from your heart. And maybe letting go of our own frailties and even getting maybe a little bit funny about them. Okay, I got that one gone, yeah.
There's something that in mental health treatment that I, over the years, didn't quite hear enough, is that the fact is, we're talking about all these things you can do to offset mental health problems, is that the fact is, when you fall off the wagon, you get back on it. And that's humanity, that's life. You don't always do the perfect refutal or rebuttal of the cognitive distortion, but you have to practice and do it over and over. It's like anything else, that you're never going to be perfect in it. Mm-hmm. And if one feels like that one has to be perfect, then things don't work. We are imperfect. Have you been able to accept that in yourself?
It's been very difficult because I know I'm definitely a perfectionist, but I think the easiest way that I was able to understand that and settle with it was holding myself to the high standards, setting these high bars, being a perfectionist really stopped me from doing all of the things I wanted to do because I was too afraid to start because I wanted to do it perfect or I was spending too much time on a plan. And it's like, well, we're humans and just the like evolution of our own learning depends on failure. That's one of the main ways people learn how to not do something. You know, you put your hand on a hot oven, it burns you. That's ingrained. Don't do that again. You don't want to do that again.
You mean we shouldn't just wait for perfection?
We shouldn't.
Come on.
We shouldn't.
Many of us have I call it, and others call it the imposter syndrome. That when good things happen, or you're doing well, or someone compliments you, well, if they really knew me, they wouldn't really feel that way or say that. And this accomplishment, oh yeah, but it's hard to say, hey, I'm a pretty good person most of the time, and I accept that, make mistakes, and yeah, I do some things well, not well. In other words, look at it realistically, rather than I'm a failure and they don't know it.
I've definitely struggled with the imposter syndrome and kind of alienation after coming back and just the coming back from the suicide attempt. I didn't tell anyone. When I went back to work, a lot of people didn't know, but I had the feeling that inside I was an alien. Like, and if they did know, they wouldn't like me and they wouldn't want this or, you know, want that. They wouldn't want to talk to me. And just understanding or like getting myself to be like, hey brain, please stop that. Like, that's enough. I'm not an alien. They wouldn't think I'm an alien, and you know, not everybody needs to know everything. But if you feel the need to share, which I did just to not feel like an alien in myself. I gave people an update, let them know what happened, and not everybody, but people that I know and that I'm close with, and that. Have ties to me. I mean, I wouldn't just go up and tell a stranger, but I also shared it to, because it is real and I went through it and that's okay. I'm still here. And you know, it's part of being vulnerable, and connecting with others.
Was that disclosure cathartic or helpful for you?
It was, It definitely was, because I had it in my mind that just everybody knew, but like it, because coming back, I already felt like I just felt like an alien. Like, I didn't fit in anywhere. I was the wrong piece of the puzzle in the wrong box, and that just wasn't true.
You just mentioned something I think all of us have a problem with, and those of us who have a tendency toward depression and anxiety have it more, is mind reading. Mm-hmm. We think we know what you're thinking about me. No idea. When you really find out, and people have done this in group therapy that I have been in and helped others do, you find out what they're really thinking. You go, really? You know, that wasn't at all what I thought you were thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So stop mind reading if you possibly can.
Yes.
One thing that Josie wrote about is that she would never think about suicide again because of how that could hurt those around her. And I know that we had on the show a wonderful lady who had lost her son, a teenager, a bright student at here in town in Bozeman, and he couldn't overcome his depression and feelings, and he died by suicide. And she said, every day I feel like I really wish I could die by suicide, but now I know that I could never do that to my family and my friends because I know how awful it feels to lose someone that way. And that's a bit of a heavy thought, but mm-hmm. at the same time, it was powerful enough to motivate her to say, I'm going to come here and I'm going to talk about this. I'm going to disclose this. I'm going to help others. And she was volunteering and doing everything she could. So, again, trying to make sure that I'm okay and you're okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was one of the big feelings after after attempting, the shame and guilt of committing suicide multiple times, and just like, you know, I already felt like a failure, and then I failed at this three times. It just like piled on, and then it was like I feel horrible for my family for what I put them through. I still shouldn't be here, and it's like, well. One thing that really has helped me kind of settle with that is that, you know, the pain stays. If you pass, the pain stays. It's transferred to others, and it's, and you know that they would all trade anything in the world to and use everything that they could to help you with that pain. And it's really hard to ask for help, but there are people that want to help you, and there are people that care so deeply about you. Like the love is there, and the pain stays, and but you get stronger, and I think that's probably the hardest part about it is the getting stronger part and realizing that it is like a granule and not a linear line back up to where you want to be. But the best part is there's helping hands along the way, and it's tough, but it's something else. And one thing with grief that I've having lost, a lot of people in a lot of different ways, it just, I think the one thing that kind of got me through that, in grieving like a loved one's death was, I heard a quote of, you know, you pick up where they left off, and as hard as that was, and as badly as I wanted to join this person that I lost and loved dearly, I found kind of the hope and love of being able to pick up where he left off and where, you know, seeing signs of him around. It's, yeah.
It's so powerful, you reaching out to help others who are in despair and knowing it could get better. And it reminded me of one time many years ago in our kitchen in Oklahoma City, the phone rang, and that was back when the phone hung up on the wall. You answered it that way. And I was standing at the kitchen sink, maybe doing the dishes or something, and Arliss was sitting at the little kitchenette dining area table, and he waved frantically while he's listening to this phone call and wrote down, go across the street, call 911, and send them here. And because you didn't have cell phones back mm-hmm. then. And I remember running across the street to Randy and Jerry's house, our neighbors, and saying, I've got to use your phone, and calling 911. And they went to this address in another part of Oklahoma City where a man was sitting in his car in his garage with the car running. And they got there in time. And we were so relieved. And it was about a week or two later, the doorbell rang, and it was that gentleman. And he came in to thank Arliss for saving his life. He said, I have two little boys, and I just can't believe I even did that. And I really, and he's been doing better ever since. He was able to address the problems that he felt he could never get around, and he was able to go forward and get the help he needed. Mm. So we're all in this together is what appeals to me here.
Yep.
That we all have those struggles at times. And if we could just somehow hold hands.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. It's definitely easier to think about it as momentarily, like that this too shall pass. It is hard in the moment, but reminding yourself that, like when I, for example, the exercising, like when my mind feels bad, it's like, well, I'm going to force my body to give me the happy chemicals. I'm going to go on a run. I'm going to take a walk. I'm going to go be outside. And, because if it's hard to trick yourself into that mindset and, get out of the painful mindset. But if you can get moving and force your body to give you that, it tends to be a little easier.
I bet there's something you could help a lot of people listening out there, in addition to how you've already helped them. We live in a world now, at least in one way, different than at any other time, as with social media. And we're instantaneously aware of the craziness of the world, people killing people, terrorist acts, our own country having dissension and being divided, people lashing out at others, and it's like an enormous, heavy burden. And I know the psychologists talk about how people are coming in and just talking about these things. The world around them is the big world, the universe to us. Any idea on how we could maybe bring that down to what we're struggling with? We can't do anything about that usually. How do you approach that?
I actually have deleted social media, like the apps off my phone, because taking in, you know, we're in an age where information, there's so much information and at the touch of our fingertips, and it really kind of stole the present moment from me, sleep deprivation, and put me in a mindset of comparing myself to others, just laying there, taking in screen time, and I think the disconnecting there, and even putting my phone onto like black and white so that it's not even really appealing to look at has been pretty helpful for me. I try to stay in touch with people as much as possible, but I prefer face-to-face communication. And putting myself in uncomfortable situations so that I can get uncomfortable with the uncomfortable, and practicing integrity when no one's looking. I mean, it's even like if there's a piece of trash on the ground, like I'll pick it up because I know it's the right thing, and it makes me feel good when I do the right thing and choose the right thing.
Then we can only do what we can in our presence, and that will aid the... In many ways, the long-term effect on the world, even though it's very small, and it's like you're very environmentally protective as well.
Yeah, I mean, growing up here in Bozeman, seeing like a lot of changes, it's, you know, the environment's important to me, and you know, while I can't plant 100 trees a day, I can pick up trash when I see it on the ground. And, you know, I can volunteer for, like, the Gallatin Watershed Coalition and plant trees with them. And, you know, there's so many opportunities to be a part of things bigger than you, but there's also so many smaller opportunities to feel good about taking care of the things that you value and care about.
Just fascinating little study I read last week. Persons who get up from a table, say at a restaurant or the library or wherever, who push their chairs back in, it's sort of like you're picking up trash when you sit, that they tend to have better mental health. Not because they push the chair in, but because they care that the next person would have to push it in or it would be in someone's way. It's like you said, the little things, the simple things. If you're walking along and you see some trash and you pick it up, okay, that's nice, but the really nice thing is you feel good about that.
Yeah. So,
and that's kind of like exercise. And I just want to say real quickly that starting to exercise is just not for young people alone. It's for any age. I mean, I decided I needed to start doing something when I was in my mid-50s and ended up trying to do a 5K in New Orleans and actually did a half marathon, which I would have told you I could not possibly do and didn't want to do. But the fact is you can all do more than you think. Mm-hmm. And those things, the little things and the positive things can really help
us all.
But even
that half marathon mm-hmm. was one step at a time. Mm-hmm. And in my case, when I did it with you, it was a very slow step at a time.
So, yeah, there are a lot of depression at all stages of life. Youth is particularly hard hit, mm-hmm. and older people are particularly at risk. So that's when doing these things that we've been suggesting could be eminently helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and staying connected, I think, is so huge. My grandma, she plays, my grandma Carol, she does cards with a group, and they check in with her. If they don't hear from her, they check in with her, and because it's, you know, they have a little community there, and the more communities they have, the more connected you are, the more comfortable it is, even with like the just staying connected. And it can be so hard coming back from things, traumatic events, to be connected. But even starting with like saying hello or good morning to every single stranger you see, if you go to the mm-hmm. store, like the grocery store, saying hello, smiling at every single
stranger. Even if they don't respond.
It's irrelevant. It's you saying hello. Mm-hmm. Just one thing that dashed into my mind, we had the people from the animal shelter on, and they talked about a volunteer activity where if it's hard for you to connect with people, you can go out and take the dogs out for a walk. They have a beautiful parkway walkway, and you can connect with a furry friend, mm-hmm. and you can help that furry friend. And that's another form of reaching out that might help you then to be able to connect with the people there and with others, because the connections are just everything. Mm-hmm. It's as you said, they're everything. Don't give up your connections. Don't get lazy about connections and stop avoiding connections mm-hmm. and connect up.
Yep, yep. And get uncomfortable. Stop staying comfortable.
We have just a couple of minutes. What would you like for people who are listening today to take from what you've been saying, Josie?
I would say that it's your survivor, and it's important to know that you're not alone, and that there are resources for when you do feel alone. 988 helpline, counseling, you know, you could even call me. I'll be there.
Yeah.
But, it's tough. It's a tough world we live in, but I just want everyone listening to know that you were built specifically for this. And
we want to compliment you for being brave, for coming on the program, and I'm sure helping at least one person, if not a whole score of people out there who are listening. And Gallatin Valley, I'm glad that you're tuning in, because I think you've heard the life story in part of a young person who's struggled and is really sounds like a good place right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we all could be at a better place, and that's what we're all working on, one step at a time. What final words, you guys? What do you have?
I'm okay. You're okay.
Yes. And it's okay to not be okay.
There you
but
go.
You will be. You are.
And we're going to end this program to say, Gallatin Valley, seek all the assistance you need through 988 Help Center. Talk to a friend. Seek out help. We thank you for listening, and we'll see you again at the next presentation.